Thank you, Jackson. And thank you for that song we just sang, Tell Me the Story of Jesus. That's actually what we do here a lot. We talk about Jesus, and we talk about the story of Jesus and how that's impacted our lives and how that's impacted the world around us. But every once in a while, I think it might be beneficial to stop and to ask kind of a big foundational question. How do we know the story of Jesus? And how do we know it's actually true? Like, there's a lot that you can get into when you're trying to discuss whether or not things are true, and we're only going to scratch the surface of a particular area of that question right now. But when it comes particularly to the story of Jesus, how do we know that that's something we can actually trust? Well, you could say, well, because the Bible tells us so. I say, agreed. I actually like that answer. I think it's a pretty good one. For Christians who accept the Bible as their sacred scripture, I think it is perfectly acceptable to take them at face value that they are telling us the story of God, and I'm going to believe that because I'm a person of faith, and I've committed myself to this, and I believe that God is real, and I believe he's communicated through these books, and so I'm going to trust these books. I think that's great. The issue with that, however, is if you're trying to talk to someone who's not a Christian, and you say, well, we know it's true because the Bible tells me so. And they say, wait, so the Bible is true because the Bible tells you so? That sounds a little bit like circular reasoning. It's hard to put a ton of validity in that. So how can you actually know that these texts are true? How can you actually know that we should trust the biographies about Jesus? So when I say the biographies about Jesus, there are four books that begin our New Testament called Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And these are our earliest sources to the life of Jesus, like as biographies. And so these exist, but some people, and I think this is as invalid as saying, well, the Bible's true because the Bible says it's true. You have some people who are more cynical and antagonistic to the Bible, and they would say, oh, you can't use those. Those are part of the Bible as historical sources. And I would say, no, actually, like, let's just for a moment, everyone in here, let's pretend like we've never heard about the Bible. And what we have are four biographies written about a fella in the first century that were discovered. They seem to be written within 30 to 60 years of the end of his life. And they have a lot of things in common talking about him. One thing that's kind of an important question to ask is there anyone else from history that we have four different biographies of written that close to their life? It's pretty remarkable how many people wrote about Jesus immediately after his life, even though he was not even a king. He wasn't a particularly powerful, but he wasn't well-traveled. He wasn't someone who outside of one particular region was well-known. He only had a three-year ministry and was crucified. But the claim is he did some incredible things, like miracles and a resurrection. Now, I would say with those things, okay, maybe it makes sense that stories about him spread. But I'll say this, if there were no miracles ever done by Jesus, it is really hard to think about how an impoverished Judean carpenter who was crucified by the Romans could end up with more written about him than any other person from antiquity. It's a pretty incredible thing. But again, all right, so we have these four gospels, these four biographies about Jesus. They were written about him relatively close to the time of his life, close enough that there could still be people alive who were alive with Jesus, actual eyewitnesses to some of the things. How do we know that these books actually are helpful, accurate representations of Jesus and his life and his ministry rather than just some legends or some myths that people came up with? I've actually heard that. I've heard people on more than one occasion compare the Gospels to Harry Potter or compare them to like the Iliad or the Odyssey. I've heard people compare them to Lord of the Rings. We actually last week did a Hobbit illustration kind of throughout the lesson. But how do we know that when we're opening up these books, we should read them from a different mindset than we're reading those types of books? There's a lot of good reasons why, and we're just going to just briefly discuss several of them. One of them is understanding the genre of literature, that they are written, intended to be biographies, and you can look at other biographies of the ancient Greco-Roman world and do some comparison and see that there's some similarities in the way that these are written and the way that those are written. But here's one thing that I think is really important to know. Just like a foundational, it's probably simple, I think everyone already knows this, but it really is important. When people speak like that, like, you know, these are just myths that were written down and then people believed them, and then Christianity grew and people spread them around, and then these legends about Jesus grew over time and all of that stuff. One of the problems you have with that is that Christianity existed before the Gospels were written. So that means something happened to get a large group of people following this Judean carpenter long before these stories about him were written. So the truth of Christianity in its origin is not found in the Gospels. It's actually found in some events that happened prior to the Gospels that led to the Gospels, that led to these books being written. And so that ends up with some important questions. Well, what were those events? Like, what do we know that actually happened? Well, thankfully, we do have some writings from some people who wrote even before the Gospels were written, who talk about some of these things. Don't forget about Paul. Paul is someone who had radically transformed his life to become a follower of Jesus, not because he read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John did not exist yet. They weren't written yet. It was the actual story and the history behind those that led to Paul's conversion, particularly meeting the resurrected Lord Jesus. That's his claim as to how he became a Christian. But when you think about the letters of Paul, we have these letters written by him to these different communities that were sprouting up along the ancient world of people who came to believe in Jesus before ever reading Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. That's kind of interesting. Again, it tells you that these stories are not just some myth that Christianity came from. There was something behind them that led to them, that led to communities being formed around them and telling these stories about Jesus. And Paul is one of those guys, and we have a bunch of letters from him. So Paul is not a biography. He does not write a biography about Jesus. However, he does, in writing to these churches, occasionally mention some things about Jesus. Most of what he deals with are practical concerns in the life of the community, but every once in a while, his answer to those practical concerns is to remind them of something Jesus did. So if we didn't have the Gospels at all we had were the writings of Paul, we could know that Jesus did exist. He's a real fella. He's a real historical person. Paul talks about him as a real person, talks about him being born of a woman. He tells us he's from the tribe of Judah. He tells us he's a descendant of David. So we know his when he lived. We know his ethnicity. We know his genealogy and his descent. Jesus had brothers whom Paul knew. So like actually zeroing in on his family. He talks about having conversations with James, who was an actual brother of Jesus. That's really remarkable. That, like, if you're just talking about the history behind the Gospels, Jesus had a real family, and we have actual written documents from people who knew his family and people who knew him. But if you're just talking about from a historical perspective, we don't have that for other people. It's pretty remarkable how early these things go and how interwoven and how closely connected they are to Jesus. We learn from Paul that Jesus had disciples. We learn that Jesus taught about divorce and remarriage. As Paul is addressing some issues in 1 Corinthians 7, he has to say, oh, Jesus talked about this, and he tells us what Jesus said about it. And then another issue arises about, well, what if a Christian's married to a non-Christian? And he says, well, Jesus actually didn't address that one. He was talking to like a community of Jews. But I'll tell you what I think on that. And then Paul writes about that. But In that passage, you have Paul, he's familiar with a body of teaching that came from Jesus. This is before Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John were written. Again, these are some of the ways that you know that those are not just stories made up out of thin air, but they came from a community that was intimately acquainted with who Jesus was and what he was doing and even what his teachings are. We have Paul explicitly quoting Jesus about the Lord's Supper. In 1 Corinthians 11, Paul will talk about the Lord's Supper, and he'll go through what Jesus did on that last night. We have that recorded in Matthew and in Mark and in Luke also, but in 1 Corinthians, we have probably our earliest record of what Jesus did, and it doesn't come from the Gospels, it comes from Paul. And so where did Paul get it from? Again, he didn't get it from Gospels that came later. He got it from the actual people who would have known Jesus and the stories that were being passed around, down around him. Paul mentions Jesus being betrayed on the night before he was crucified. In 1 Timothy talks about Jesus testifying before Pontius Pilate, and so we're actually getting like names of real governors. By the way, that's an interesting thing about the Gospels. When they tell you that Pontius Pilate was the governor of Judea, They're not the only things that tell you that. You can look back and you can see who was governor of Judea at this time. It was a guy named Pontius Pilate. When they talk about like the line of the Herods, like these are all Caiaphas and the different and Annas and the different high priests. Like these are people you can actually go back to find the setting of when these events were taking place. That's quite different than a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away or something like that. You know, there's actual time, place, names, and all of that stuff that are in the Gospels that are historically verifiable. Paul tells us that Jesus was crucified. We're getting to like the key gospel events that led to the rise of Christianity, that Jesus was buried, that he was raised on the third day. Paul tells us the number of the day was. He gives us a list of people who had seen him right after. This is all 1 Corinthians 15 right here. But Paul talks about these in other places also, like the crucifixion and all of that. What is all of that to say? It's to say, even without the Gospels, reading letters written from Christians to other Christians, even earlier than that, you can pretty well put together the major events of the life of Jesus that led to the rise of Christianity. That means that if the Gospels are written and they're making stuff up, then they're doing so against the views of a community that already exists. It's going to make it a whole lot harder for the Gospels to be accepted. But if the Gospels are written in a way that is retelling these stories and these stories that already existed before them, then you're able to see how people read them, they spread, they ended up becoming such an important part of people's faith and understanding of Jesus, and eventually became part of the script of the canon and what we call the Bible. So, one thing to know just from the get-go is that the Gospels, Christianity existed before them. So it's not that someone made up a story, wrote it down, and then people started believing it. There was something that happened. I believe the life, ministry, death, and resurrection of Jesus that turned a group of people who were not followers of him into followers of him. It changed this group of monotheistic Jews into people who worshiped this guy as a man. These people who honored Sabbath started worshiping on Sundays with one another. Like, all of these transformations took place before the Gospels were ever written. Pretty incredible if these are just made up stories, that they're making up the story that preceded them. But number two, you can actually look at the Gospels themselves and you can know that these authors, they seem to know what they're talking about pretty well. And I'm just going to talk about some of the most mundane things you can ever think of. I'm not going to talk about anything super important right here, but just mundane details in the Gospels that show they're pretty careful in the way that they write. Consider geography and topography. All right, let's think about this for a second. One of the common phrases that's used for going to Jerusalem is going up to Jerusalem or going down from Jerusalem. Do you know why? Because Jerusalem was the highest, like one of the highest elevations in the area. When people went there, they went up. So like, you can't Google at this time, like how high, you know, Jerusalem is and all of that. There weren't a lot of maps around. People generally knew this type of stuff by walking. Like, you know, oh, this place is up. And so for us who are familiar with maps, sometimes we get confused because we are looking at a map of like, this is what it kind of looks like from what a satellite would show you. And we look at it and we say, wait a minute, it says going up even though he's going south. Well, they're not writing in terms of north and south when they're talking about going up. They're talking about the fact that I'm breaking a sweat and my legs are tired and I keep having to go up. But you can do that and just look at that type of language going down from Jerusalem to Jericho. That's one of the steepest declines in one of the steepest roads that you're ever going to walk on. But right there, like that's the language that's used. And it is a steep decline from Jerusalem to Jericho. Went down from Cana to Capernaum. You go ahead and compare them. Went down from Nazareth to Capernaum. Like, Capernaum's pretty low. That's the language that's used when people are going there. All of this is to say, like, that doesn't prove that it's the word of God or anything, but it does prove that these people who are writing are familiar with the area. We will compare this in just a second to people who are writing some things about Jesus who are not actually familiar with the time and place, and you'll see that the differences are like monumental. But if you just take the Gospels, there's 26 different towns mentioned. Some of them are really important ones that everyone would have known, like Jerusalem. Some of them are like tiny little places like Sychar or something that you just like, when we first moved here, and it still actually happens, people will name little towns outside of Maryville. I have no idea where they're talking about, but they're from here, and so they know what they're talking about. They know where they are. They know some things about them. But it's like, there are signs that whoever is writing these things is pretty familiar with the area that they're writing from. In fact, the Gospels show familiarity with towns, both great and small, different regions by the names that the locals would have called them, gardens, mountains, bodies of water, travel routes. Like travel routes from, it gives two different routes from Galilee to Judea that people would have commonly traveled, and we see those routes discussed in other pieces of literature also. Synagogues in different cities, pools of water, like the Pool of Siloam and things, different gates, like the Sheep Gate, Solomon's Portico. Like you can go through and you see not only cities, but you see geography, you see topography, you see architecture, you see like all of these things mentioned in there. And many of these things, like, we have access to now. We know exactly where they are, and we know that we have other writings that talk about them. And so all of that is to say these guys aren't making up a story out of thin air. It's rooted in something that they really know about. Compare that to later legendary gospels. Those exist also. Like, a lot of people wrote about Jesus for hundreds of years. We do have what later legendary gospels look like. I'll give you three different examples of different types of gospels. The Gospel of Thomas, that mentions Judah once. And that's the only location mentioned in the Gospel of Thomas. The Gospel of Judas, these were discovered, different ones were discovered at different times, but there was a huge discovery at Nag Hammadi where we found a lot of, we sometimes call them Gnostic Gospels, but these are later developments on the life of Jesus with different takes and different perspectives on it. But the Gospel of Judas doesn't mention a single place. The Gospel of Philip mentions Jerusalem, Nazareth, and the Jordan River. But it's like, you look at these and these are written by people who were not from there, who likely don't know a ton about the area that they're writing about. And so they'll add in, you know, maybe what they do know here and there. But there's a stark difference between that type of writing and what you're actually seeing in the Gospels. You're at least seeing that there's some intimate familiarity. Later Gospels, without firsthand knowledge of the time and place Jesus lived, don't give us the same sort of details at all that you get in the Gospels themselves. And that's just, I was just talking geography and, you know, stuff right there. When it comes to culture and customs, you can go on and on and on. When John the Baptist is executed, because he was preaching against King Herod and his marriage to Herodias, right? Who was married to Herod's brother Philip, and then she left Philip for Herod, and then they got married. John the Baptist is speaking about that. You know, all of those are real people. You can pick up the writings of Josephus, and he'll give you really interesting details about that whole scenario. Again, that's not a story made up out of thin air. It's like whenever you do see names of people who had government positions and things like that, you can go back and you can see that this is written in a real time and place by real people involved in real events. This is an interesting field of study. Names in the ancient world. I put Simon and Mary up there just for a couple examples, but there's a lot of other examples. Think about Simon in the Bible. You know anyone named Simon? Well, there's a guy named Peter. He was called Peter. Like, Jesus gave him the name Peter, but his actual name was Simon. Simon Bar-Jonah, Simon son of Jonah. He's called Peter, which means rock. That's like a nickname. There's a guy named Simon the Leper is what they call him. Because a lot of people shared the same names, they come up with it. They're called disambiguators. Ways of distinguishing between this Simon and a different Simon. So you have like Simon Bar-Jonah, or just call him Peter. You have Simon the Zealot is one of the 12 disciples. He's known as being a zealot. You have Simon the Leper. You have Simon of Cyrene. You have Simon the Sorcerer. It's like we have all these different names for all these different Simons, right? What about Mary? Think about how many Marys you've read about in the Bible. You know, when you say Mary, you still have no idea who you're talking about. It could be 20 different ladies, you know? It actually is. I'm trying to remember. I think there is a number. It might be like 18 different Marys mentioned at different parts. But then, so you have, you know, Mary, you know, mother of James and John. You have Mary, the wife of Clopas. Like, you have these different ways of distinguishing them. Why am I mentioning the names? Well, because you know what one of the most common names of people in the New Testament is? Simon. And one of the most common names for a woman in the New Testament is? Mary. If you were to look at ancient Judea at this time, you know that about one in every four women was named Mary. Interestingly, that's about the same ratio you get in with the Gospels and the book of Acts. Same thing is true with Simon. Simon is the most common male name. It's also the most common name in the Bible. Why is that significant? It just shows that when they're writing even names of people, it seems to fit really well with what we know about the naming of people in that time and place. It's like, that's not the type of thing that someone who is kind of distant, writing much later, doesn't know a lot of things, is just kind of making up a story, is going to get right. But they actually get the common names right of what most people were named at that time. When they talk about money, they talk about like Corban tradition, which was devoting money to the temple. That was a controversial topic in Judaism, but they know about the customs. Tax collectors, chief tax collectors, what cities they are in, like all of that stuff you see just glimpses of in the Gospels that corresponds to what we know about Israel at that time. Botany, some of the plants that are mentioned, sycamore trees in Jericho have been discovered. That's what that little guy climbed up, Zacchaeus. But like you read through and you'll see the plants, all of that stuff is true to the time and the place and the area in which they were being written. You can go on and on and on about naming governors or naming kings or naming different aspects of geography and topography and botany and the names and all of that stuff. There are some books that do this. I'll recommend two really quickly. One of them is written by Peter Williams about whether or not you can trust the Gospels. He's the principal of Tyndale House at Cambridge. Richard Bauckham, world-class scholar, wrote a groundbreaking work, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, talks about a lot of these interesting things. But anyway, all of that is to say, one way that you can know the Gospels aren't just myth is not only to know that they're based on stories that happened before them, and we have evidence of the truth of these things prior to the Gospels, but also when you just read the stuff that's in the Gospels, it's true to what we know about history at that time and place, even in the smallest details. And if you're going to be right about like that type of nuance, makes sense to me that you probably are going to be trustworthy with some of the bigger things as well. Number three, the Gospels don't shy away from even giving embarrassing history. So the reason that's important is because if someone's making up a story to make you want to believe something, they're probably going to put in like the best stuff that makes the story credible and that makes you like the story. Whereas when you read the Gospels, there are sometimes things in there that are historically true, and that's why they're in there, but they're not really the type of thing you would want to put in there. So I'll give you an example. Jesus being baptized by John. That was kind of a controversial thing. Why? Because ordinarily the way people viewed things is that the person doing the baptizing is kind of the authority or leader, and the person being baptized is the one who's like the disciple. And that could falsely convey that John the Baptist is greater than Jesus. So that's one of the reasons the Gospels go through great lengths to demonstrate, no, even though John baptized him, Jesus is actually the greater one. John says that. John says, I'm unworthy to even untie his sandal. There's a reason that those types of things are in the Gospels. It's helping answer some questions that people might have. Additionally, what do the Gospels tell us about the baptism of John? It was done by people confessing their sins. It was done for the forgiveness of sins, right? And then Jesus is baptized by John. Well, if you have the Christian belief that Jesus was sinless, you don't want him baptized by John, right? It's like that's going to just come, that's going to create another issue that you have to explain. But guess what? Every one of the Gospels, four different witnesses have Jesus being baptized by John in the Jordan River. Okay, so why are they doing that? If it doesn't help their story, why are they doing that? Because Jesus was baptized by John in the Jordan River. Like, that's just the fact. That's why they're doing that. But they do also explain it. So if you remember when Jesus walks up to John in the Gospel of Matthew, John says, I'm unworthy to do this. You should be the one baptizing me. Wouldn't that have been cool? Like, if I was making up the story, that's what I would have done. I would have had John, I would have pictured him as this great guy. Crowds are going out and being baptized by the droves, right? And then Jesus walks out there, and everyone in awe steps back. And John says, what are you doing here, Lord? And Jesus says, John, come here. And then Jesus grabs him, and in front of all the people, Jesus becomes the one who baptizes the baptizer. That would have been really cool to show how great Jesus was, right? But no, that's not what happened. That's the type of story you invent to make it sound like he's really great. But that's not what happened. And so that's not what's in there. And again, there are things like that. There is in the Gospel of Mark this story where Jesus heals a blind guy. And again, I think there's a reason for the way it's told this way. But he heals the guy. And the guy was blind. And then he says, do you see? And he looks around. He says, I see people or trees, or they kind of look like trees, and he can't even tell what he's seeing. And so then Jesus touches him a second time, and the guy ends up being able to see clearly. If I'm making up a story about the world's greatest healer of all time, I'm not going to have two takes in there. I'm just going to write it as smoothly as I can, try to make them all sound really, really good. But again, why would he do that? Again, I think there's a reason why that happened in the Gospel of Mark, but the point is the Gospel writers weren't afraid to show things that might be considered embarrassing if they were true. For example, the disciples became early leaders in the church, people like Peter and people like James and some of these guys. If you read the Gospels, they particularly don't look very good. They are called hard-hearted. They're deserters, deniers, betrayers. Like, the disciples are often pictured in a very embarrassing way, where if they're controlling this message, they're probably not going to want that to be the way that people think about them. But again, it's not about trying to make up stories that people will like and will give you authority. It's about actually recording what happened, because there's a community of people who already know these stories that if you start writing things wrong, your story's going to get rejected. I mean, that's happened. And so also things like women being the first to report the resurrection. The resurrection is a significant monumental event, and it was written at a time where sexism was kind of the rule of the day, and so there were views about women being untrustworthy sources and untrustworthy witnesses. They weren't allowed to testify in a court of law, and yet each of the four Gospels agrees that it was women who first discovered the empty tomb and went on to report about Jesus. If you're making up the story, you're going to say something more credible than someone who people don't trust at all being the earliest witnesses. But again, if that's what happened, that seems to be what they wrote down. Number four, I think you get some evidence that the Jesus presented in the Gospels is an authentic Jesus rather than a creation of the early church to try to help in whatever they were trying to do. I'll give you just a couple examples. One, Jesus on the cross above his head has this plaque entitled King of the Jews. King of the Jews. You know why that's important? Do a word study on that phrase in the New Testament, and what you'll see is it's mentioned in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and never anywhere else. You know what's interesting about that? That was not a phrase that early Christians, like in the letters of Paul, he never calls Jesus that. He calls him a lot of things. He might be king of the whole world or something, but he doesn't call him King of the Jews. That was not an early Christian phrase that they regularly used to describe Jesus. So here you have Jesus on the cross. If they're making up the story and they're putting this moniker above his name to describe, what has brought him here, they could have put something like Son of God. They use that one a lot. But no, they use one that Christians don't ever use. Why? Well, because it's not just Christians making up a story and putting in their phrases and things like that there. That was the phrase that was on him. That was what the charge was, that he claimed to be King of the Jews, right? Even though that didn't catch on as a popular Christian designation for him, that is what you see in the Gospels. There are a lot of things in the Gospels that the church at the time, if they were making up the story about what was going on in their own time and place, rather than decades earlier in the time of Jesus, things would have looked a bit different. Here's an example, circumcision. What was like the biggest controversy that the early church was suffering through? Read the letters of Paul, read what the early church was going through at that time, and you'll see that discussions about circumcision and Gentile circumcision and all of these things were like massive questions that the church was having, right? And it was dividing the church. There were some who were preaching that people needed to be circumcised. You know, when the Gospels were written, that was like the biggest issue that the church was facing. Guess how much Jesus says about circumcision in the Gospels? Like nothing. He doesn't tell anyone to or not to be or anything like that. He doesn't even mention the topic. He has controversies like Sabbath, which you don't see very much in the New Testament at all outside of the Gospels. Why are they, like, if they're making up a story of Jesus, just have them solve your problem for you and say, Jesus said that they don't have to be circumcised. If you're making up the story, you have that kind of freedom. The problem is, circumcision wasn't the issue Jesus was dealing with. He was dealing with arguments about Sabbath. And the early church wasn't dealing as much with arguments about Sabbath, but they were dealing a lot with circumcision. And so because of that, you see a difference in the issues that Jesus is battling and the differences the early church is battling. That, again, is evidence. They're not just making up the story to solve their problems or to make their message more palatable or something. They're actually telling you what was really taking place, even when it diverges from what would be helpful to them. If you're making up a story, you don't have a crucified Messiah also. That's one of the biggest hurdles to evangelism, is the crucifixion. Why are they saying it?
It's because Jesus was real and was really crucified. The bodily resurrection doesn't help with, much with evangelism either, especially when you're preaching, to Jews, because they didn't think that there was going to be an in-time resurrection of the Messiah, and to Gentiles, because they didn't believe in a resurrection at all. In fact, a lot of Jews didn't believe in a resurrection at all. Sadducees didn't. Like, some of the leaders of the Jews didn't. Resurrection gets you made fun of. In fact, that happens to Paul when he goes to Athens, right? So stories of, like, crucifixion and bodily resurrection don't really help unless there's actually an empty tomb and there are actual witnesses and there were real experiences of a real resurrected Lord. By the way, when it comes to things like the crucifixion, you can look at Roman sources. Like, there's a Roman historian, Tacitus, who speaks specifically that it was during the reign of Tiberius, Jesus was condemned to death by crucifixion by Pontius Pilate. And it actually mentions Jesus, it mentions Tiberius, and it mentions Pontius Pilate. Like, all of that stuff you get from Roman records as well. So, all of this is to say the Jesus who's presented in the Gospels doesn't seem to be a made-up guy to help the church. He seems to be an authentic Jew living at the beginning of the first century who is dealing with those conflicts rather than someone who is kind of invented to help the church become a message that's more palatable or easy to understand. And then finally, we'll close with this. The Gospels do contain eyewitness details. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are said to be the authors of the Gospels. Admittedly, the Gospels are anonymous. The closest you get is John, which John says these stories do come from the beloved disciple. But we're not told explicitly who he is. Tradition says it's John. Tradition says Matthew. We have a second century guy named Papias who wrote, and he basically said, like, Mark, John Mark is the guy who wrote the Gospel of Mark, and he got his message largely from Peter. And then Luke got his message largely from Paul. And so there's kind of like, that's the tradition. But one of the things that's interesting about that tradition is particularly names like Mark and Luke. I don't think those are names you would invent. If I'm inventing the author and just trying to make it sound authoritative, I would just say Peter, you know, or something where it's like, that's a well-known figure. I wouldn't say John Mark, the guy who abandoned Paul on the missionary journey, like, and is like only appears here and there a few times. You're going to pick some people who are bigger names who can give some authority behind your message. But that's not what they do. And the reason why is because most likely these are the guys who actually wrote the books. In fact, our earliest manuscript evidence, all of it, has these guys. We don't have much dispute about the authorship of these guys anywhere in church history, like that it might have been someone else or anything like that. The tradition comes from very early days and remains consistent throughout, including in every manuscript that we have that records the authors. There are issues like this, or deals like this, which I think this is such an interesting passage. This is Mark chapter 15 and verse 21. This is Jesus about to be crucified. A guy named Simon of Cyrene comes and is compelled to help carry his cross. Just notice the way Simon is described right here. Mark chapter 15 and verse 21. They pressed into service a passerby coming from the country. Simon, by the way, there is another Simon, of Cyrene. And then he says, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to bear the cross. And then he just keeps going on. Notice how he describes who Simon is to his audience. This guy's the father of Alexander and Rufus. What does that tell you about his audience and their knowledge of Simon? They might not know Simon very well, but they know his sons, right? They know Alexander and Rufus. That doesn't make any sense at all to say if there's not some connection there between the audience that he's writing to and Alexander and Rufus. One of the things that's also really interesting is that our earliest traditions are that Mark was written to the church in Rome. And when you read Paul's letter to the Romans right at the end of it, he gives this big, long list of people. One of them is Rufus. And he actually mentions Rufus's mother being someone very dear to him. I think it's very likely that Simon of Cyrene may have become a follower of Jesus after these events, and his sons became known to the early church. I mean, clearly his sons were known to the early church. What does that tell you? That tells you there's actual history behind this that's connecting, like, real dates and times and people and eyewitnesses, people involved in the story helping press these things along. He can actually mention the name of his sources here about some of this information. But you have Luke, who begins, and Luke admits that he's not an eyewitness, but he talks about his conversation. He talks about gathering information from eyewitnesses who would have been alive at that time. And the Gospel of John ends with the passage that Jackson read for us to start off, with the declaration that this comes from an eyewitness as well, and that's how these stories were recorded. And I would say, based on the date, the early tradition, the information in the Gospels, the things that you might expect them to have if they were made up that they don't have, comparison between the Gospels and later legendary texts, and the information that we have in the letters of Paul before the Gospels, I think there's a pretty good reason to think that these actually were historically credible documents written by people who actually knew what they were talking about. And I, as a Christian, would go ahead and say inspired of God himself. So, having said that, that means the story of Jesus is true, something you should trust, something that there's real reason to put your faith and confidence in. And if you're willing to do that this morning, you could be saved, have your sins washed away, name Jesus as Lord of your life. We pray that you would do that. You could confess Christ, have your sins washed away in baptism. You can talk to some of our elders in the library in the back, or you can come and sit on the front row while we stand and as we sing.